That's a nice day to practice, nice day to study, nice day to spend some time contemplating on the precious and the profound path of teachings of the Buddha. So I'd like to encourage everyone to begin today by generating bodhicitta, giving right direction to our engagement and the connection to this very profound path of practice. As all of us recognize the absolute rarity and the tremendous opportunity that we have of having obtained this precious human existence, knowing it to be as fragile, impermanent, transitory in nature. Nevertheless, while that fragile and impermanent life, as rare and precious as it is, may be, still its power needs to be understood. The power rests in its incessant creation of cause and effect, powerful causes that meet with diverse conditions, some that are within our reach and control, and many more that are beyond our control. However arises, manifests powerfully in then becoming the consequent experience of samsara. Spending time in reflecting upon the important foundation of the four reminders, a practitioner needs to recognize the importance of considering these essential points, recognizing the profundity and the truth of this wisdom path, and lead it in the direction that is free from the distortions of the same ego-cherishing, self-grasping attitude and mind. None of us begin by thinking or imagining that the engagement with the Dharma needs to be distorted or polluted by our own afflictions and obscurations. Nevertheless, the deceptions of the ego and the power of responding to the impact and the impulses of habitual tendencies, one very often does not realize how much and how easily we do bring about distortions even to the teachings. Therefore, may my mind generate a sincere wish to bring about the genuine ripening of the path of hearing, contemplating, meditating, and engaging in the profound teachings of the Buddha. And may that path be untainted by the impulses and the impact of the habitual tendencies. May the worldly dharmas of one's own agendas, agendas of self-grasping, agendas of freeing oneself from fear because of which arrogance and pride unnecessarily arises, agendas of seeing the path as a way, as our teachers have said, as a hunter's attitude that hunts for a precious musk and in order to obtain doesn't realize that one may be inflicting tremendous harm on the deer to obtain what we want. May the attitude of relating to the Dharma as a way of obtaining for one's own gain, for one's own realization, such taintedness, pollutions into the path of Dharma, may it be completely purified. May one generate awareness. May one be able to approach Dharma as purely as is required and find the wisdom and allow it to be protected and guarded by the courage of an honest path of practice that leads to training one's own mind, such that the training of the mind becomes itself the vehicle of happiness, cause of happiness, and ultimately the liberation of self and all sentient beings. So generating this strong intention becomes very essential, known as the generation of the right intent of bodhicitta. And so reflecting in this way, as we begin today's session, this morning's session of some discussion on the topic of engaging in the path of compassion through training and taming of one's own mind. Now, this path of taming and training of one's own mind is brought down to us in the form of many of the teachings. before going into the text itself, or just part of some of the slogans in the text that we can talk about, it is crucial for meditators today to understand the lineage in which the teachings have been brought down. I always remind people and say, you know, through these 2,500 years of Buddhist teachings, it has always been held within a lineage of practitioners to whom the teachings have been given in its entirety and purity, and the students themselves have held it in its entirety and purity. So therefore, the added responsibility that we all have is to not to be among the first generations of who have received it in its entirety and purity, but have given into a sense of complacency and convenience, which imagines that we can sort of dabble with it at our own convenience and take only parts of it which are more convenient to our own self-cherishing attitude. So the danger of such sort of half-hearted approach to the practices is to be avoided. That strong determination to fully embody the teachings, something that we spoke about yesterday, last evening, is very essential. The training of mind system began or was propounded through many great teachers of the Mahayana teachings. Particularly, remarkably, we find the figures such as Bodhisattvas, such as Shantideva and Asanga, from whom the tradition of the Bodhisattva path engaging in training of the mind actually originates. Tibetan Buddhism, and for Kagyus and Nyingmas particularly, we find the teachings embodied within the tremendous treasury of teachings of Jangung Odro Lototai, who brought into a much more sort of propagation as well as compilation in very accurate language, in a language that is approachable and a language that is, however, retaining completely the essence, the teachings of those great Mahayana teachers, particularly in the context of training the mind, Chekawa's teachings. And so Chekawa himself was not only known to be an excellent scholar and a practitioner, but he himself was one of the revolutionaries in terms of, I think, using more sort of English words, a revolutionary in terms of newer ideas into the teachings of Dharma, which is, I think, essential for us to keep in mind because we talk about transforming mind. But transforming the mind has to be made and understood by making the teachings very accessible to one's own self. Where the teachings do not become accessible to one's own life, to the daily living moments of one's own life, then we have no other option but to see everything that we do, even this Buddhist teachings that we do, as a religion to follow. Now, of course, do we remove the religiosity of all the rituals and practices and the approach to Dharma? Then that's not what I am talking about, because when we speak in the context of methods and the benefits of methods, human mind will require, because it has different potentials, therefore it will require different approaches. For some, the religiosity of it will be perhaps much more powerful than the precious doctrine itself. And so there are benefits to that. Nevertheless, there is a fine line between that religious approach becoming simply something to adhere to, believe in, without embodying, and that's the problem area that can be retained, that could be retained. Similarly, if we look at history of Buddhism, now when the Buddha Shakyamuni passed away into Mahaparinirvana, when he obtained enlightenment, subsequently it is very clear that the Buddhist teachings did go into being held by great masters such as Mahakashyap, such as Ananda, and so forth, and subsequently all the teachers. But at the same time, we have to also keep in mind those impactful situations that did occur throughout the history where Buddhism began to become a very arrogant, profound but arrogant philosophy, distorted by some minds that sort of made it into a very exclusive, almost a corporate kind of an approach, I would say. And so the exclusivity and sort of sense of because it's very profound, because it's very, very extraordinarily brilliant, it the intelligent mind is so much connecting with it, it gradually, in India as well as in Tibet, in the later centuries, yesterday I pointed out certain centuries, such as I said, 7th century, 10th century, 14th century, 17th century. Those centuries that I didn't mention are clearly those centuries where we do find frictions or gaps beginning to happen. And the gaps mainly was that the common people thought Buddhism was inaccessible. It just became tremendously difficult to connect from one's own mind, especially in developing a spirit of thinking, this is what I can do in my life. This is something that I could embody in my day-to-day life. Rather, the influence became, oh, this is something very profound, very true, but so difficult that as a common person, I won't be able to actually cultivate that in my own life. Now, if we look at today, 21st century, and westernization of Buddhism, it is probably also the same thing. I often think, the way we are approaching Dharma today, there are a group of very elite scholars and students who do exert tremendous effort, have devotion, and at the same time do very well in understanding the teachings. They usually fill up the first, I don't mean here, but they usually fill up the first row of any sangha, isn't it? But then there are plenty more people like myself who feel afraid, and therefore that fear gradually, psychologically in the mind tells you, revere this philosophy, venerate this philosophy, have devotion to this philosophy, but be careful. This is not something you can do in this life. So that's why I always jokingly say, we begin to place more faith in next life. Yeah. So we say, yes, precious human existence, next life. Yeah. You know, better chances, earlier start, you know. So we keep placing that hope. So what we have to look into is the human mind that begins to play tricks. The actuality of the situation here is the ego is gleefully telling you, yes, you're being sensible, you're being honest, you are doing what you are capable of doing, don't jump. And so occasionally you do hear the same teachers say something like, don't imitate a lion's leap, you'll break your back. So that confirms what your hesitation and your doubt is. And therefore we begin to say karma, but then the ego sort of distorts the belief of the karma into, yes, become subdued by your karma. Rather than being on the driver's seat, become a passenger, sitting next to just the destiny or the version of destiny of the karma, and allow it to be so powerful that you do not engage in the sort of spirit or the inspiration, encouragement, and the determination within one's own mind. That's where Dharma does begin to become something that we have tremendous respect and belief in, but not necessarily something that we embody completely, engage completely. Because in our own minds, we think that's very difficult. So how many of us actually spend every day thinking it's difficult? Difficult to be kind, difficult to be learned, difficult to have wisdom, difficult to have trained mind. So this whole concept that it's difficult, it's difficult, it's difficult, we brainwash ourselves into believing its complexity and difficulties. And the result, the consequent result of it is that habits are happy, ego is completely content, it has no problems with you attending a talk every Saturday or Friday. a little smack doesn't do much to dethrone. So it says, yes, the smack is actually good. The whack is actually good for me. Because on the long run, it sustains its supremacy over our own basic wakefulness. So Chekawa, the great master from whom the tradition of the 7 points of the mind training arise, spoke greatly throughout his lives. Our teachers would often recount how often he would speak against the elite approach, the elitist's approach to Buddha Dharma. In Tibetan society at that time, there was tremendous discrimination between the higher class and the lower class. not so abjectly said to be higher class and lower class, but by virtue of the aristocracy, and especially the scholars becoming very learned and establishing of great monastic education and systems, the exclusivity of the Dharma made a large population of Tibetans very, very distant and did not have any approach to Buddhism other than being supporters of the monastic institutions. And the sense of offering, sense of sort of servitude to the community of scholars and teachers was very, very prevalent. And Chekhawa chose to come out of that system, especially choosing to teach only those who were social outcasts. Now, in the text, it's very often written as he was so sympathetic to the people suffering from leprosy. Those of you who've read the history, you know that Chekhawa talked and gave a lot of teachings to the people of leprosy, those who suffered from leprosy, outcasts, social outcasts, and considered to be very, very sort of out of the community. Normal society would not relate to these people. So particularly the teachings of Tonglen. Now, in the Lojong training, you all are familiar with the, after the first introduction of the absolute bodhicitta, relative bodhicitta starts with immediately the practice of in meditation, the training of Tonglen, sending out good thoughts and happinesses and cause of happinesses, taking on the suffering of the sentient beings. But you must also know that the Tonglen teachings' main emphasis and the growth of it in the Mahayana tradition of Tibetan Buddhism began with Chekhawa's approach, where he taught a method that was very approachable to people who felt left out by Buddhism, left out by that very profound philosophy that they thought in their life, due to the circumstances that they were suffering, they were not able to actually have an approach, have a connection to the path of teachings. Similarly, sometimes it becomes essential to look at today's approach to Dharma that you have as Westerners. And very oftentimes, as I said, there are excellent scholars, excellent students, and excellent retreatants. We have Western scholars, we have Western philosophers, Western teachers, Western yogis, Western monks, Western nuns, Western trukus, Western kempos, Western geshes, and so forth. But then we also have a growing community of elitists. And so the approach, the sort of relationship that we have to the approach of Dharma is of a certain exclusive intellectual class. Those who propound and speak very profoundly things that are without any argument, very true, very, very true. But personally, for myself, for example, then I may have mentioned this because I mention it all the time since I feel it very sincerely. Someone like me, I find it very difficult to socialize with Buddhists. Truthfully. This 10 to 12, 3 to 4 or 5 kind of engagement, and then some personal sort of discussions about your practice and so forth. That is okay. That's my job. And it's okay to do it. I'm fine with that. But beyond that, the dinners, the teas, just the sort of speaking to one another as friends, this I find over these years, almost now more than two decades, I find increasingly difficult. And when I look at why is it, Jigme and I, both of us think very same. She is also a very quiet person, doesn't like to do this. And we often say, are we being here very, very rude by always saying no? Because people are very kind. They say, we'd like to take you out to dinner. We'd like to come and have a meeting with you. We'd like to have something, tea together. Can we take you out? Can you drive you out? And so forth. And the 100th answer we give always is no. So sometimes it comes across as being very rude. Personally, I never socialize. Why? So is the same reason. And when I look at it, it's because there's tremendous sort of difficulty, tiredness in sounding intelligent all the time. Isn't it? 2 hours a day, 4 hours a day, 5 hours a day? Fine. But, while drinking tea, while eating something, while sitting down quietly, when you have to still sound intelligent, profound, then it's not your natural nature. And since it is something that is forced, the forcefulness in the attitude becomes extremely tiring. But now, if we look at it, we do it. No matter whether I find it tiring or not, I have to examine in my own self and see, why does that happen? And so when we look at, you know, how Buddhists talk, how Buddhists actually relate to one another, there's a very sort of an intriguing situation that we often find. There's you, and then there's the Buddhist you. And why is it not the same? Best situation here would be is that same intelligent profoundness that one is able to speak about actually be something that is generated from one's own mind stream. Now, Chekawa's tradition, the great Mahayana exponent from whom the training of the mind comes, he is said to have been a great scholar, but he chances upon one day a small piece of paper where it is written, gain and victory to others, loss and defeat to myself. And he was very struck by it, and he wondered, because he was such a scholar, he wondered, where is such a profound teaching being taught? And he heard, oh, there's this great Mahayana teacher called Geshe Langri Thangpa, and he is the one who coined this phrase. And so he went in search of Geshe Langri Thangpa, but he had passed away. And however, he chanced upon Sharawa, Geshe Langri Thangpa's disciple, from whom he received the training of the mind teachings. Now, Sharawa's teacher, Geshe Langri Thangpa, however, one of the greatest proponents of Mahayana teachings in Tibetan Buddhism, he is said to have, again, in his own teachings, said how he learned the importance of embodying training of mind in one's own self from a thief. And so some of you may know the story, but a thief one day broke into a wealthy person's house, and in the dark, trying to find, couldn't find anything, but found a big barrel of Tibetan beer chang. And so he was very thirsty, so he began to sip the barrel of the beer, the fermented beer, and then got drunk. And after getting drunk, he started singing loudly in the dark, how wonderful it is that I am able to taste this chang from the mouth of the barrel. How more wonderful it would be if I could taste the bottom of the beer barrel. So sort of his song was how he could drink the whole thing, that he could even taste the chang from the bottom of the barrel. And so this is said to have illuminated the mind of Geshe Langri Thangpa, who then sort of changed the phrase into how good it is, how nice it is, how wonderful it is that I am able to practice the Dharma from my mouth. How more wonderful it would be if this Dharma could be also practiced from the bottom of my heart. So that became the basis of training the mind in the form of these verses and slogans that we have today. Of course, Langri Thangpa himself studied from other great masters, Domtenpa especially, and Domtenpa became Atisha's student, and Atisha was from India. And so we have the whole history. But the point here is, how did these teachers connect to the teaching of training of the mind? Did they memorize things? They must have. Did they only understand the philosophy of it? They must have. But beyond that, they were able to squeeze the essence that approaches in a common man's approach to really allowing one's own mind, one's own heart to become the container in which the essence of training mind and the generation of awakened heart, and that awakened heart being heavy, heavily laden inseparably with the attitude of kindness, attitude of compassion. That then is the sort of core basics of training of one's own mind that we must never forget from. The same Geshe Langri Thangpa is said to have smiled and laughed, smiled once in his life and laughed once in his life. The rest of the time he was called Mursuto. Mursuto means gloomy face. That he never smiled. And his disciples, since he was an excellent teacher, he had many students, the disciples constantly sort of requested him to at least have a little happiness in his face, in his demeanor. And he always said, if one reflects upon the attitude of ignorance and the causes of suffering that we create, how can one be happy? If one really looked at how an untrained mind created so much unnecessary happiness for oneself and the others, how could such a mind actually not feel the gloom? Not that he was in depression, but at the same time, there was a thorough and an accurate sort of seepage and an understanding of what we are doing, what we human beings are capable of doing, and how we do not respond to that capability, to that potential. When he studied from his teachers, Drumdenba, and at the passing away of his own teacher, it is said he promised three things. I will never keep any possession that I have received after sunset. So every day, whatever he received, he always gave away before the end of the day. I will never be in a place where more than two people know me. And so he always changed places, living anonymously, students finding him, looking for him all the time. But because of his teachings and people knowing him, he never was able to stay in one place for very long. And that the third commitment was, I shall never look for victory and gain to myself, but accept defeat and loss. And this shall be the basis of my training, of my own path of practice, which I believe to be the fundamentals of what the Buddha taught in the second turning of the wheel of Dharma. So that became his own practice. And that is from such a practice that we have today the 59 slogans of how to train one's own mind. The very spinal, so the backbone of the teachings becoming how to engage in daily life with the practices, with the view of the practices. And so here again, as I was mentioning, Western Buddhism, sometimes the intellectualization of the teachings becomes so very emphasized that everything is up there. We know it. The intellectual mind, whether it's logic, whether it is emptiness, whether it is the importance of compassion, everything is known in the intellectual mind. But that intellectual mind needs to come down to engaging in the practices, which I think is much more beautifully done in the Hindu tradition, in the Christian tradition. So Buddhists sit, meditate, generate immense amount of, I always say, light and warm breath, to the others. And so, of course, when we talk about practices such as Tonglen and meditation, these are taught, and you have probably an excuse of saying this is what has been taught to us as being a very profound path of practice. So that's a valid reasoning. On the other hand, if that is simply retained, I always joke and I say, if I was on the receiving end, I don't think I would like so much hot air to be received at the time, especially when I need a much more gentler physical presence, someone sympathetic to sort of listen to what I have to say, someone who's sort of emotionally generating a sympathy and an understanding to the situation that I am in. So if there is a time where I need some physical presence or some verbal presence or even a mental thought that is expressed, I would like it to be something that is very much present, something that is approachable, something that is a support for me, rather than sort of an intellectual understanding. And so, however, in our case of a sort of practitioner's lifetime, lifestyle today, we do find that maybe some amount of work is being done, so I do find some change happening. But more or less, still the problem is wherever there is little need for human beings to really be expressively kind, we do not find as many Buddhists in that situation as I would find a Christian or as I would find a Hindu. Now, because I live in India, I do find it's a difficult country in so many areas. But wherever there is the need to do something, whether it is a natural disaster, whether it is some kind of a very difficult situation, I find that the accessibility to approach for help is much more among the Christians and the Hindus. So they're very ever-present. So in that context, I do find that maybe we have tremendous good approach to the understanding of absolute. But we are very, very careless, or we're very, very ignorant, or almost indifferent to relative compassion. So therefore, generosity is also a philosophy. Patience is also a philosophy. Ethics is also a philosophy. And where it comes down to doing it, we simply imagine it's empty in nature and then sort of come into a very dormant passive state, which I think does tremendous damage. In the teachings of the Buddha himself, he talked, first turning of the wheel of Dharma is based upon three subjects: Four Noble Truth, the 12 Interdependent Origination, and the Eightfold Noble Path. And so view, meditation, and action. The view is the four noble truth. Meditation is on the 12 nidanas. And then the action engagement is the Eightfold Noble Path. But the Eightfold Noble Path is something to do that challenges and sees how much your meditation has been strong enough and understood, realized accurately, such that the view is very apparent in your conduct. First, as the Buddha's teachings, you cultivate right view. You cultivate right action. You cultivate right speech. You cultivate right thought. You make sure your livelihood is right. You make sure your effort is fully engaged. You make sure you're developing right mindfulness, right concentration. In the beginning, you do it just as in the Mahayana teachings, the 37 practices of the Bodhisattva. The engagement in the five paths are the sort of paths of practices that we inculcate and we cultivate in our own lives, and we try to engage in them. Through engaging in them, we meet a wall, the impediment of those that the Buddha talked as causes of suffering. Until then, there is suffering. The suffering is caused by ignorance. We would love the cessation, and therefore we walk the path of practice. That's our intellectual belief. But when you cultivate wholeheartedly right thought, right speech, right action, then we understand what the Buddha meant when he said, cause is ignorance, because the ignorance that is understood here is not of some concept of ignorance, an intellectual theory of ignorance, but ignorance is just the blunders that we make where we have our body and it doesn't do the things it should do. Where it is my speech and yet I have no control over the speech at all. Where it is nobody else's thought, my thought. And how difficult would it be if we have a small child running around in the shrine room? What's our first attitude? Why is the parent not responsible for the child? Isn't it? So who would keep the child still is the parent. So it's your mind. It's your thought. Who would be responsible for the running around thought? We would ourselves. Whosever mind is projecting the thought is responsible for the thought. But then we are not aware of it. So here, the acceptance of the path as a challenge makes us have a much more intimate understanding, personalized understanding of the view. Then here, it doesn't matter who said it, Buddha or Duda. I just changed the B to D, isn't it? Name is name. So Buddha or anyone, truth as it is, becomes the basis of one's own confidence. That seeing the wisdom, seeing the accuracy, seeing the truth as is most apparent through your own experiences of it is the irreversible confidence. That's the devotion. Later on, we've called it devotion to the Dharma or devotion to the Buddha. But that's temporary. Here, what you have connected to is sort of matter of fact, the very logical awareness, logical understanding of how it is, that it is truly ignorance, and therefore ignorance was not a word coined by the Buddha. You feel it, you experience it, and you see it as the cause of suffering. So where that sort of clear understanding of the teachings become apparent in your own mind, and that becomes the basis of your own confidence, the sense of sort of making sense of such a teaching, such as the path of practice, cultivating right view, right thought, right speech, right action, doesn't become adhering to a religion or adhering to a philosophy. It makes sense to do that to one's own self. And so the meditation, such as the introspection and analysis of 12 Nidanas in the context of the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, becomes the bridge between the view and the action. So that ultimately, you become the view. Then there is no longer developing right thought because the Buddha said so, but it becomes the natural response to your knowledge that it is your thought and therefore it can be corrected. It should be corrected. Not correcting it would be succumbing to the ignorance, the cause of suffering. Developing mindfulness doesn't become a lofty, pretentious, sort of a exclusive thing to do, but it becomes the most sensible, natural thing that every human being with a sane mind should cultivate. And if the Buddha said so, very good. But that it is true is much more powerful than who said so. And so when the naturalness of embodying the, in this first turning, if we take the example of the first turning, if you become the natural embodiment of the Eightfold Noble Path, where it doesn't even have to be called eight, but that who you are is nothing but right. Your actions are right, your thoughts are right, you're mindfully right, and you are aware, and in that awareness everything is right, then there is no view to adhere to. You yourself embody the view. And so, first turning of the wheel of Dharma, view, meditation, action. In the same way, second turning of the wheel of Dharma also, further expounding the teachings where the Buddha taught, again three subjects, where he talked about the five aggregates as the view. He talks about the 18 elements, further investigation, meditative investigation, analytical, critical analytical sort of approach to 12 Nidanas, further explained in the form of working with the first three Nidanas, particularly in the context of 12 elements, what is the nature of mind? And then, again, similar to the action explained in the form of the Eightfold Path in the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, five paths and the progression of the 10 bhumis, and the five paths much more elaborately commented upon, which today we know as the 37 practices of Bodhisattva, the basis of also the Lojong training that is there. Whether it is in the form of eight verses, whether it is in the form of 7 points, whether it is in the form of 59 slogans, whether it is in the form of the Jesutome's Asanga's teachings on 37 practices, all of them are actively engaging in day-to-day activities, challenging yourself to working with the view that we hold as Buddhist teachings. Wherever the view and the, wherever the meditation, rather than bridging the gap between view and action, disconnects both of them. And then you have a view that is as high as the sky. You have a meditation that is as heavily rigid as any solid structure can be imagined. And you have an action that is non-existent, not reflective of the view. Then there is confusion. And that confusion is very, very unsettling to one's own mind. And so we do not know what to do at that point. And what we do is, just as any person who is confused does, and the example is, if you throw a person who doesn't know how to swim into the water, the first reaction is to try and grab the water, fully knowing that you can't grab the water, but that's the reflex sort of reaction that we have to it. And it is in the same way, is that when we are confused, when we do not know how to actually bring together the view and meditation and the action, we will immediately grab into whatever is most easy to grab to. Sometimes it is blind faith. Sometimes it is an enormous attachment to form practices. That's when meditators begin to say, I love shamatha. You know, I always think that's a very dangerous thing to say. Yeah. Alarm bells sort of go in my ears whenever somebody says that. It's because, yes, of course, one can't argue with that, because shamatha is itself such a profound practice that one can't but fall in love with it. But then if that is what Jangmugong Rinpoche says, hibernating in meditation, then a bear or gopher hibernating and a meditator escaping into this comfortable state called shamatha is not different. That, for a moment, creates a sense of comfort and a sense of feeling distant from all the confusions that we feel. But it doesn't become powerful enough to uproot lifetimes and lifetimes of habitual patterns. Therefore, it becomes essential to truly make sure that the meditation or the approach to your practice, whatever it is that you are doing, whether you are very new, consider yourself so new, you do not know anything other than sitting quietly, to many different forms of practices and meditations, particularly as you become more familiar with Vajrayana practices, all the different methods that you come, knowing and having the strengthened awareness to bring them all together into bridging the gap between view and action becomes essential. It has to bridge these two. And the bridging and the success of the bridging becomes more apparent when one is able to really see the non-difference between the view that you hold and the actions that you project. If deep down in your mind you really think you should, that kindness is important, that developing mindfulness that is more powerful in that it subdues the tendencies of feeling and being impacted by the impulse of greed, of selfishness, of unkindness, that it is able to recognize that, should be immediately apparent and embodied in your physical actions of body, speech, and mind. That is the mark of a trained mind, of a tamed mind. So you write essays and citations on trained mind and trained mind. That's not doing anything spectacular. It's a good effort. There's a lot of effort involved in that, so it's appreciated. But that does not prove your devotion. That does not actually embody having understood the Dharma until it is evident in the characteristics of the person, in the character of the person, in the attitude of the person, personality of the person, of the nature of the person, so that those whom you meet need not be told Buddhism is good. That's apparent. You do not need to convince, especially some of you who have difficulty with family members not understanding why you chose to become a Buddhist. And there's always this big thing about, should I try to teach them how to meditate? Isn't it? Now, it's all done with a good intention, but more than anything else that will convince them to knowing that you are not on something that is cultish, that is something that is a kind of a, again, another a distraction in your own life, is to be able to live the example of what you have thought and what you would like the others to understand as a profound path of practice. So if it is compassion, if it is a trained mind, if it is the ability to be more patient, then more than extolling the philosophy of it, it is to be able to live that in your own life. Is it going to be difficult? Of course it's going to be difficult. But that difficulty is there because of one's own lifetimes and lifetimes of having sustained a false belief of a self that needs to be cherished, the same hope and fear. It is also the lifetimes and lifetimes of falling prey to the impulse of habitual patterns, of neuroses, same that inflicts tremendous suffering and ignorance in the others is the same that oneself experiences. And therefore, being able to recognize the importance of cultivating training mind, not as a theory to examine, theory to believe in, but generating it in one's own mind. And the best way and the sort of swiftest approach to that is to immediately take all the slogans, all 59 of them into practice, to be able to actualize it in one's own life. Such as when we talk about, for example, in the context of the Lojong trainings and relative training of mind, there is the first one that goes into three objects, three neuroses, and the three virtues, the three seeds of virtues. And so the slogan is very simple. There is very strong attachment, the three negativities. The first one is very strong desire, very strong attachment to the object that you love very much. So strong is such an attachment that beyond the attachment itself, the mind often doesn't care or doesn't see the need and the well-being of the others. And so looking into one's own self and seeing, there's all your devotion, there's all your understanding of the emptiness nature of mind. You also know, as we spoke about last evening, everything is a projection held by your own mind. Nevertheless, when the dominance of that strong attachment begins to manifest, we forget. We forget where that single thing becomes more important than the whole. And the everything, the wholeness of our whole universe is completely drowned in the dominance of that projection of one's own self. To tame the mind, first observe this condition, this tendency in one's own attitude. Next time when that attachment comes, you have to look into it and say, here is this meditator on the path of Mahayana, and how easily the mind actually does go into a strong sense of attachment. So blinding, that attachment is so blinding that it doesn't let us actually see anything but the sort of fulfillment of your wishes with regard to that particular attachment. Next time you get irritated and you become angry, watch yourself. That neurosis called the anger is the manifestation of this tremendously strong emotion that you have allowed to be so exaggerated, that it completely exhumes, completely engulfs every other thing. You cannot see anything beyond that. Not only that, some of us then drag it around for long, long times. We call it grudge. So holding on to it. So observing in one's own self and seeing the dominance of that. This kind of observance of how we exaggerate a simple thought, giving it colors, names, flavors, supporting it with previous experiences, memories, making it bigger, exaggerating it, aggravating it more and more, must be observed within one's own self. This kind of an observance, this kind of a tendency that you find in your own nature, in your own attitude, is much more powerful than any meditation, than any recitation, than expression of any form or mechanics of any other kind of a practice. So learning about it. Day to day, how much devotion or how much exertion of practice, wanting to practice, an understanding of the Dharma may be in our own mind. But observing within one's own self this pervasive attitude of indifference that is there in our own nature every day. We shut our minds and live in a state of almost denial that others exist. It's a very sort of a funny thing that we all indulge in. We know others are there, but we sort of still do not become aware of the others. Bottom line, of course, is because of self-cherishing attitude. The self is so big that others, everything, from one to, let's say, a billion. And we know a billion is more than one. But at the same time, when the one becomes so very important, the significance of even a billion drizzles down to becoming so insignificant, so not there, that the one itself becomes supreme, very, very big. So that kind of an attitude, known as indifferent attitude, that is nothing but dullness of the mind. Distraction because of the self. Dullness, that is the weapon of the self-cherishing attitude. And the laziness that arises, which is indifferent to the feelings and the needs of the others. So three poisons. This ignorance, the sense of negation, sense of denial, just stupor and dullness. The anger, the aggression, the aggravation, apprehensions and anxiousness. Sense of, especially the anger that we always feel is in the restlessness. That we just cannot rest completely. Is itself the very fertile ground that leads to it meeting with factors that are, again, aggravating to its own self. And therefore, this then sort of becomes increased in the form of irritation, in the form of fear, in the form of things not going your way, and because of which passive as well as active aggression arises. And so desire immediately is the great supporter of that aggression. So both of them go together. So this is primarily when we say the very root basis of our not knowing the true nature are projected and sustained through the producing of these three root poisons. First, in order to transform them, in order to eliminate from one's own mind stream, recognizing the power of these three root poisons must be there. To those that we love very much, the attachment must be recognized. Questioning how the prominence of that love is there. So as our great masters have said, loving is very kind, but when the love is given so that it sustains self, then there is actually no love. It's a very deceptive kind of love. That's why the person that you love very much doesn't eventually, what do you call them, the seven-year itch or something like that, when doesn't go your way, then fierce enemies, whether it is between partners, whether it becomes between siblings, between parents and children, between friends, Sangha members. And one day you find nothing but good qualities, the other day you find nothing but faults in the person. So that is then the sort of shifting of all the emotions that we have thought is love. And recognizing that it is actually a disguised selfishness, self-cherishing attitude, quoted like a bitter medicine coated in sugar. So in the same way, sort of disguised in what we imagine to be love. And those are all in the realm of emotion that sustains the self-cherishing attitude. Recognizing that. Therefore, what is this attachment? What is the need for such an attachment? Likewise, the anger. If the anger, and most oftentimes we think, anger is for the correction of the others. When I grew up, terribly angry all the time. I can remember most of my growing up years. And if someone says, the other day there was someone who was interviewing, and of course she was doing a book on women. Women in Buddhism or something like that. So when you have a book coming out on women teachers of Buddhism, as it is, there are few, as we all know. So those who are few have to probably have the image of being great, isn't it? So the poor young girl was asking me, what is your first, memory, or what do you remember that impacted your life and so forth? And I know that people are looking for answers that are profound or, again, intelligent and great things like you're recalling your past lives or the enormity of the wisdom arising and so forth. Problem is, I don't have any such memory. The memory I do have very strongly is of having tremendous problem with anger, being very angry. And then in my early 30s, some of the people who interviewed, and then I would talk about this anger, I always said, well, that there was a reason why so. I lived with 500 monks. Isn't it? So therefore, you had to, in some ways, become rough and tough and really, really sort of have that aggressive attitude in you. Today, I look back and I think, that's not true. There was no reason. There was no reason, no real good reason why that aggression had to be there, other than One thing that I am very sure was the main cause, and that is the fear of not getting your way. Fear that what you wanted, what you thought was necessary, not having it, not obtaining it, not getting it. So it does go into the same affliction that is common to everyone. And that is, the anger often gives us a sense that it is a very effective way of obtaining things that you think is necessary. In my case, I used to often think my anger is actually good for the monks. Today, in working with students, for example, I'm known to be someone who scolds people very much. And people always say, oh, you scold them very much. And I always think, well, I have to scold because I'm correcting them. But now today, again, as I grow older and I look, I think I don't scold them so much for their own benefit as much as I scold them to get my way again. Isn't it? So those are different approaches when you look at aggression and the habit of aggression. Aggression only done for the purpose and the benefit of the others. There is such a thing as wrathful compassion that we know our fierce deities. And in the iconographies, if you look, there is some supposed to be there. In Guru Rinpoche, Padmasambhava, there is the expression of stern compassion, as we say. But I am not Guru Rinpoche, neither are you Guru Rinpoche, I think. And until we have that kind of a realization, then the ability to transcend anger into genuine wish to benefit others alone is an extremely difficult thing to do. Therefore, it's wiser to identify anger as something that is predominantly coming out because of the self-cherishing attitude, selfishness. Even those that we think are beneficial for the others, if you are honestly able to approach and analyze it, one finds that it is for your own convenience, a shortcut to getting your way. And in the process, if it does something good, then that's the bonus, isn't it? Such as the other person thinking he made a mistake or she made a mistake. The ignorance is also the same thing. Whether it is outer distractions that breed ignorance, whether it is inner absorption that breeds the dullness, the stupor, and the laziness, still breeds the self-cherishing attitude, sustains the self-cherishing attitude. Being indifferent to the others is also an attitude that is a natural response to the self-becoming, so very important that you cannot see anything beyond the self, the needs and the comforts, benefits, and the aspirations of the self. Therefore, these three root poisons, discovering, recognizing in one's own self, in your daily attitude, looking at the magnificent display of these three that come in so many varieties of ways, some very gross, easy to identify, some so sort of subtle and so made to look necessary. That subtle sort of deceptions of these three root poisons are very, very difficult to actually recognize, since they are so very ingrained in our own attitudes, and the deceptive sort of appearance of these three root poisons are so very difficult to capture. The best and the swiftest way is to simply go through the Lojong trainings, the training of the mind, abstain from them altogether. We would love to have the kind of bright, intelligent, and unmistaken clarity that is able to discern and analyze and defeat it by critical analysis. That's a method given in the teachings. But there's a lot of wisdom in the simplicity of the Hinayana tradition of simply letting them be uprooted from one's own mind stream. And so transforming them into its positive qualities, three seeds of virtue. Simply do not get angry in your life. And so sometimes you have to think, how many philosophies would you require before you actually understood that? And that's a waste of time, especially if you keep impermanence at heart. Then it is a waste of time. Therefore, keeping it very direct, what is harmful for you should be eliminated from your mind stream. Reflecting upon suffering of sentient beings, this makes sense. Reflecting upon the karma and the power of causes that can actually become tremendously impactful in the lives of the others, it makes sense to remove the root poisons. Looking at the fragileness and the transitoriness of life, that short life has to be led with so much pain, doesn't make sense from that perspective. It makes sense to eliminate root poisons from one's own life. Preciousness of human existence, from that perspective also, it makes sense to uproot the root poisons from one's own life. And therefore, not becoming angry. Letting go of selfishness, self-cherishing attitude, of desires for the self. Letting go of this attitude of indifference and dullness, a non-appreciation of this very tremendously valuable and beautiful human life that one has obtained. And instead, if one must do something, then generate nothing but genuine patience. Be tolerant, be patient, allow a flexibility of attitude to arise that is nothing but patience. Whenever patience become difficult to practice, and when we think, oh, patience doesn't make sense in this situation, immediately go into the contemplation of the 12 Nidanas, of causes and effect, and especially the wisdom of the teachings of the Mahayana, where the Buddha talks about compoundedness of the realities. Nothing is only what it seemingly appears as. But being able to broaden one's mind into understanding all the factors that go into the buildup of a certain situation. When we talk about grief, we talk about, and we say, where does the grief come from? We often come to, well, this grief isn't actually one. And we say, oh, this is a long story. Behind every sort of a strong emotion that we are feeling, whether it is angry, whether it's anger, whether it is any kind of grief or pain, we know that it is a long story because there are lots of things to it. It begins somewhere when you were born. It begins somewhere where you met this person. It begins somewhere with the choices you have made in your life. And those choices and those relationships and those occurrences in your life, meeting with many other circumstances that build up a situation that almost at this point seems to have no resolution to it, no solution to it. And so in the same way, that is also the same approach to be taken in the context of every other aggravating situation that is so strong, seemingly so strong, that we find very difficult to have resilience, patience towards. And so knowing, increasingly allowing your mind to then also be cultivated with the wisdom of contemplation, with the wisdom of meditation. And so one doesn't talk about sitting in meditation and thinking about the emptiness of mind or emptiness of phenomena for other reasons other than this, is that where you cultivate an analytical approach to how things become, how things originate, how each situation, even such a thing as a simple thought, is a built-up process of building up from many different causes and conditions. There are senses, there are the sense consciousnesses, there are the sense objects dependent upon many different factors, senses dependent upon many different factors, sense consciousness particularly dependent upon many different factors, which are lifetimes and lifetimes of impulses and information, familiar information that it has retained. And therefore, the build-up process of every simple thing, just as one thought is not independently just a single thought, it is the build-up of lifetime of experiences. Since the moment you were born to this moment, you have not been idle, not doing anything. Your senses have been gathering information of all kinds. You've learned to say red is different from yellow, which is different from green, which is different from blue. This itself is an enormous amount of information, comparative information, divisive information that you have contained in your own mind. And these and a billion other kinds of information that has sort of segregated things to be identified as different things is a tremendous buildup, mountain-like buildup of information that you file through every day to make sense of one single thought. And so one single thought is a buildup of all that information. For example, it's like clicking into a certain thought. And then the whole process that the computer-like mind has to go into then seeing how that thought fits into your preferences, into your grasping, to your aggression, which degree, 67.9 degrees impacted, isn't it? In the context of desires, 54.9 degrees of impact, isn't it? So it's a sense of, you know, it's an example of how the familiar patterns, what we call habits, and that habit which gives us a sense of how to relate to these familiar impulses, build up. And in our very quickness of having to make a decision, we ignore the fact of that compoundedness, of that compositeness of many different factors. And we are very lazy in nature. And the laziness teamed up together with the busyness, both of them then joining another very sort of a useless thought that we have or an attitude that we have, which is not only are you busy, not only are you lazy, but you have to also sound intelligent, isn't it? So you give your judgment very quickly. And so it makes more sense to say, I like. It sounds very intelligent. You've expressed your opinion. But that opinion has been based upon such a lack of understanding of compoundedness of reality that just simply blends in into consolidating the ignorance even more. So as we become older and older as we live life, what we assume to be a very clever life, since it is able to address and sort of express so many judgments and opinions, but the same judgments and opinions that we hurriedly make, that we lazily make, continually consolidates and affirms and reassures you the steadiness and the still maintaining of the ignorance of not knowing the true nature. So the mind becomes duller and more dull. It begins to sustain its own sense of sort of almost unawareness, non-awareness of the completeness, of the wholeness, of the gathering of the sort of collectiveness of things as they are composite, as they are sort of compounded together. And so that's then the sort of manifest resultant state of our human existence. And that is an extremely unkind. If you look at it carefully, such an opinion, such a judgment that lacks in a thorough understanding of wholeness of a situation is one of the most unkindest thing that we can express to the others. When we talk about resolving a certain misunderstanding, how often do we emphasize the fact of listening to both sides of the stories so that both of the people are able to present their own side of that argument for a person who is trying to resolve that situation to have a bigger picture, a better picture. But the same thing is never applied to the opinions and the judgments that we have of the others. We say so easily, things I like, things I do not like. And based upon that, we find ourselves distant from those that we do not like. And we become enormously attached to those things that we love very much. Without giving it a thought of how much both the situations have worked terribly hard in creating a buildup of a certain situation. So if we say, for example, this table, and I can walk up the stairs and tell Adrian, I don't like this table, isn't it? And so similar to simple sort of a expression, I like this table, I don't like this table, both of these are heavily biased and coming from a very lazy mind that doesn't understand work that goes into it. And so if we look at all the amount of work, love, care, concentration, effort that went into not only this table, but everything, That person who's able to look at the wholesomeness, the wholeness of any situation, would never be able to logically come up with a single opinion, like or dislike. There would be just a sense of, deepened sense of ability to appreciate everything that has compoundedly, collectively gone into the buildup of a situation. In such a case, if the mind were able to hold that kind of a wholeness of a situation, that mind would have to be nothing but free from bias and partiality. Where the discrimination, the bias and the partiality has a natural exhaustion, such a mind couldn't be but kind to the others. And so because of this, the Mahayana teachings say, emptiness is the most essential understanding from where genuine compassion arises. Not because you negate the presence of reality, but because you understand the beauty of gatheredness of many factors that go into the buildup of that appearance. Everything is composite. Everything, every thought, every form, every sound, everything that we are and our mind is able to conceive is a beautiful blending, coming together of many, many causes, many, many conditions. How can a mind truthfully see one as more important a cause than the other? Therefore, where is the relevance of decisive opinions such as good versus bad? Where is good? Where is bad? What is beauty? What is ugly? Is there really such a thing as this better than that, were we to go beyond the apparentness to investigate all the other different factors that come together? And so the very sort of subjective, immediate decisions that we make, good, bad, nice, mine, yours, beautiful, ugly, I like this, I don't like this, because of which we sustain an ignorant emotion such as anger towards some, desire towards the other, indifference towards the other. That's the foolishness of a person who has just sustained a hurriedness in one's life, so speedily propelled by the impulses that you absolutely have no clarity of seeing things as they truly are. And so when the Buddha had to then sort of put that into the words or how to actually allow a human being to begin to even ponder about this. So given a chance, how would you approach? If each one of you were given an assignment today to express the same thing that you are able to know here to the next person that you meet down, walking down or driving down the hill, where would you start? How would you start? And when you reflect upon that a little bit, then you begin to see, oh yes, one would start by telling the person perhaps to sit down for a while. So the whole tradition of stillness of a posture, silence of the speech, and allowing the thoughts to be let go of are the unique sort of, I think, methods that arose from what I call the genius mind of these great masters that would enable us to see very clearly what is very apparent. But in this sort of humdrum of our habitual patterns and the influence of these habitual patterns in our lives do not always make it clear to us to be able to look at it as accurately, as directly as it should be. So therefore, when we work with the slogans, three poisons, three objects, and the three seeds of virtue, this is the approach that has to be taken into one's own self. But there, just as a key unlocks a treasury, likewise, the unlocking of the treasury of understanding, this very profound slogan, very, very important slogan, is to begin with a strengthened determination to eliminating three root poisons. And instead, allowing nothing but patience to be practiced. Instead of anger, patience. Instead of desire, kindness. genuine love, genuine kindness, instead of ignorance, a sense of impartial love beyond any kind of bias and partiality, embracing things as they arise in front of you wholeheartedly. These are the three seeds of virtues that have to be cultivated. And no sort of questions such as, how long should I do this? Or in what circumstances should I do that? Also, very intelligent questions such as you all ask about, what if? Every time I always joke about it. What if a person is holding a gun to my head? What do I do then? Do I still practice patience, or do I try not to get shot? Those kind of seemingly good questions that you all do ask. And I always say, many years ago, I used to give all sort of whatever good answers came, polite answers came, ranging from duck, to look at the nature of your mind, to all kinds of questions. So now today, after having lived with you all for now most of my life, I have sort of come down to a much more comfortable situation where I say, most likely that will never happen. Isn't it? And therefore, since it is most likely never going to happen, don't worry too much about it. Keep on track to the teachings. So today, the chances of your not having someone hold a gun to your head being more sure. Therefore, simply work with the determination. Don't get angry. Don't become so selfish in your own desires that you cannot think of the well-being of the others. And do not become so ignorant as to not know that there's a person sitting next to you, that a person behind you, the warmth that you feel is of a being next to you. To come to such a point where the loftiness of the profundity of the philosophy makes us believe that there are some many billions of sentient beings awaiting liberation through our realization, and where the immediacy of your own conduct is something that you're very ignorant to. So, a few weeks ago in Washington, D.C., we were receiving the Kala Chakra from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Some 13 to 15,000 people, deeply touched by the embodiment of Cherezik Avalokiteshvara, great compassionate being as His Holiness. Whenever His Holiness would either enter or depart or even do simple gestures, there's the sort of, especially among those who we now call ourselves fully practicing Buddhists, there is this absolute beautiful humility of the body that comes. Everyone bows. There's a beautiful smile. There's hands in anjali. There's a sense of, I think at that moment, probably His Holiness could have broken a glass, and that would be a great, profound instruction. That's how the heart connects to it. But particularly, there's one point where His Holiness is leaving, and there's heartfelt, genuine devotion and gratitude for His Holiness, and everybody behaves so beautifully. And then as soon as His physical presence is gone, there's a dramatic change in the mannerisms of those who are left behind. There's nudging, there's pulling, there's pushing, there's rude behavior. There is a sense of sort of, one-upmanship everywhere, frowning, if not verbal abuse, which was very much heard, especially among the monastics around there. Very surprising. But that kind of a situation talks of the greatest challenge that we have as meditators. What does Buddhism mean in our lives? What is Dharma in our lives? Is Dharma something to emotionally feel good about, inspired about? Or will it actually come to a point when it leaves the domain of emotionality to becoming your own natural understanding of its sanity, of its truthfulness, of its need to be manifest as a being, since you hold that capacity within your own self? That decision is the crucial juncture between Training the mind being a philosophy, a wonderful path of practice, to training the mind becoming your own individual practice. Whenever we begin to take that as our own individual practice, it is at that moment that you fully embody Dharma in your own life. No longer will you then be dependent upon the question, how do I cultivate Buddha Dharma in my own life? Whatever you do becomes practice. Because even after those years and years of rigors of studying the Dharma and going through retreats and practices, eventually the result we ask that comes out of it is a person free from anger, ignorance, and desire. Is it only dependent upon you sitting in a meditation box? Is it really only dependent upon that? Those things are essential. They do help. They do help otherwise a mind that would probably never sit down in the first place. But that it is only dependent upon such a structure is again distancing the core essence of Dhamma from your life and making it so distant that that is what will then probably make this very profound philosophy just a religion and another wonderful philosophy.